Today is Wednesday. It's November 25th, 2020, the worst year ever. Hi, I'm John Williams. And by the way, it is also Green Wednesday, the day to buy and consume marijuana. Setting up the technology as we did for this thing, I could use some. You can hear me weekdays from 9 to noon at WGN Radio.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
From the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter.
I'm Eric Zorn, the thankful columnist from the Tribune.
Aww.
Maybe at the end of this, we should all just chime in and indicate something we're thankful for besides our families, although I guess that is what we should be most thankful for. So since we last spoke, guys, the head of the Government Services Administration, Emily Murphy, has released the funds to begin the transition from a Trump administration to a Biden one. She said because of recent developments involving legal challenges and certifications, she has released the hounds. By most accounts, I'm hearing that she's not a partisan hack. She's not a Trump flunky, but I'm not clear why it took her so long. None of the electors have voted yet. So it does seem to be sort of a subjective, well, I think I'll do it now sort of decision on her part. And if that's the case, then it makes me wonder why she waited so long. You know, I don't want to crucify this lady, but I don't know that she gets off the hook completely here because of her delay. What am I missing, guys?
Yeah, I don't think you're missing anything. You know, she said that she acted after the Michigan Board of Canvassers certified Joe Biden's victory in that state. And of course, there was so much attention on whether that board was going to do that. And it did, but only by one vote. One of the Republican members abstained. And I think had they not certified, it would have at least given the Trump campaign more time to try to push the question to the state legislature, which, you know, I think could have overturned the results of the elections. But I think that once that happened, it sort of closed off that avenue. Let's also not forget that, you know, there were more Republican voices calling for the transition to start, including Pat Toomey, the senator who's retiring in Pennsylvania, who said, we got to get going. It's over. Joe Biden is president-elect after a judge appointed by Obama, but with long, deep roots in the Republican Party in Pennsylvania, basically laughed Rudy Giuliani and co. out of court.
There was a really good Politico story by Tim Alberta on that lone Republican vote on that obscure Michigan board of canvassers, I think it's called, or something like that. And it's this guy, kind of a no-name guy who's been, you know, in Republican circles in Michigan for a long time. And it was his single vote that kind of almost stood up to the leader of the free world. And he had this great quote about, like, we're a government of laws, not of men. A great story of sort of courage from this one person.
There was also a really interesting letter sent by kind of bipartisan, I believe, congressman, one of our congressmen here in Chicago, U.S. Rep. Quigley, was a signer of that. And it questioned why this was happening, that they wanted to meet with her, with the head of the GSA about this, and gave her a deadline of Monday. And then there was sort of some back and forth saying, well, you can meet with my deputy, the GSA saying you can meet with my deputy next week. And they were saying, no. Yeah. In that correspondence was a question, and it's too long to get into here, but was a question about how that agency was actually rejiggered in September. And the suggestion there was that an attorney was brought in with ties to the Trump campaign, and what his role exactly was, because there would be no reason otherwise for her to put the brakes on it, but that this attorney was weighing in somehow. And it didn't seem to be, I mean, the person I looked, you know, the person did come to work for the federal government, in the fall. And so I think there were some questions that way too. Was this the plan all along? And that was the final piece of correspondence. And then, I don't know, I want to say an hour or two later, she just announced, okay, we're going to move ahead with this. So I don't know if it was sort of an accumulation of all these things, but it was very curious.
Yeah, I think a critical mass of pressure was brought to bear on her. And it just struck me all along as being really irresponsible. The whole point of transition, funding the transition, is that you want to have this relay race aspect to the leadership in this country. And not facilitating that with Joe Biden suggested, first of all, that there was a reasonable chance, a better than average chance even, that Biden was not going to be inaugurated in January, which completely went against what everybody was thinking and saying. But if you wanted to hold out on that, you can say, well, okay, then let's say there's a chance. There's still a chance that he was going to be president. And if there's a chance, a pretty good chance that he's going to be president, you ought to be getting up to speed anyway. I mean, I don't remember what they did in 2000 when Gore and Bush were haggling it out. And that wasn't exactly a transition of power, but Gore was vice president at the time.
So they sort of split the baby because while the recount in Florida was going on, they gave both Bush and Gore some access to transition services, but not the full complement. And if you read the 9/11 Commission's report, part of the cause of 9/11 they found was because the transition was delayed. Yeah. And it's, you know, so frustrating that, you know, we as a country should have learned that lesson to not mess around with transitions, right? But, you know, 20 years later, here we are, and not so much.
Well, and therefore she becomes partisan by omission, right? Because if you don't enable the next possible administration to come in, then in fact, you are working for the other side. And I don't think she can unpaint herself from that corner.
Yeah, it's not like she was keeping funds away from Kanye or something, right? I mean, here's another question. Is the transition period too long? You know, originally it was even longer before. I think it was in March, which is when the transition happened before, because, you know, you had to get all these people had to get on their horses and get to Washington. Even now, it seems like it's an awfully long period between an election. The lame duck period is really long, and Lord knows what mischief Trump is going to make.
If I really recommend Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk, which came out and covers the Obama-Trump transition. And that, if you read that book, you will come away believing that the transition is much too short and is not sort of codified by laws in a way that is incredibly frightening. And I had the misfortune of reading that book just as the pandemic was beginning to surge. And there is a whole chapter in that book about how poorly planned the transition dealt with potential pandemics. And this was, of course, written in like 2017, 2018. And we all, I feel like, have developed our own pet peeves to be frustrated with during this pandemic. And that has been mine, because it's just was so clearly, you know, a potential threat that just was not taken seriously.
I did read that book, and I, in fact, interviewed him about that. And I didn't think about it in those terms, Heather, but I did think about it in terms of how much we should appreciate the work that those civil servants do. Yes. The swamp is there for a reason, and it's a good thing generally. And every now and then somebody percolates up where you go, oh, that's not working out so good. But by and large, those people are giving their lives to doing services we'll never appreciate.
Well, when the campaign is going, I believe that the leading candidates are briefed in on a bunch of stuff. I mean, they get Secret Service protection, and I think they get some security briefings and intelligence briefings when they're the leading candidates.
Correct.
It seems like you could accelerate the transition process through law by having that process of briefing and getting people up to speed accelerated. So they could have access to things like being able to do background checks on people. Because that's one of the things that was hampered, right? Is they don't have the money. They didn't have the access to do the kind of background checks you would need for cabinet appointments.
Well, I mean, the way it's supposed to work is that once there's two nominees, those two nominees start meeting benchmarks set by the transition process. And part of that is figuring out who they want to go through the initial background check process with, and then being ready to submit those, you know, to the GSA right after Election Day. So that was all done under Biden's pre-transition plans. So that's what the delay is. It's not like they're starting from scratch on those background check processes.
So Heather, did I understand you correctly that Michael Lewis argues that the transition should be longer?
That it would and that it should start further back in the election. Like essentially, like once there's a clear nominee for both parties, that there should be a formal sort of, you might be next president next. We need to sort of start putting those things in place.
I would certainly agree with that, but giving the lame duck period extra months, that seems perilous to me. You've got a guy Trump, who seems to be trying to just screw things up for Biden right now.
And it might be one of those arguments that doesn't age very well after Trump, because so many of these processes just sort of chugged along in the background for so many years. I mean, who has ever said the words Michigan State Board of Canvassers as many times as we all have, right? So that all of this worked exactly as it has, but nobody paid any attention to it. So the question is, what should we learn from Trump sort of pressing on these pressure points? How should we change them to make them, you know, stronger and less, you know, at risk of, you know, Democratic, you know, overturnment, for lack of a better term?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this sounds kind of wonky. Should the GSA or the transition go quicker? At the end of the day, what we're talking about is Donald Trump's failure to acknowledge that he's lost this election. If he had directed her to do so, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And as of early this week, one of his attorneys, not Sidney Powell, who was even too cool bananas for them, but that other attorney, she still says this week that they have won the election by a landslide. And I thought, well, maybe that's what you do if you're an advocate. I hire you. You're my attorney. You're going to go in and say I'm not guilty, even though they saw me kill the guy. So maybe she's just doing what attorneys are supposed to do. But the stuff that she and the president are continuing to post is utterly preposterous. That's central to this.
And it's getting more preposterous by the day. After every certification, there's a great tweet on that says that Joe Biden has won so many times in Michigan that he needs to legally change his name to Ohio State.
Well, I'll pull up the president's Twitter right now, but he's mostly he's been on page. It's funny, too, because more than half of the president's tweets now are flagged for being false. Which is not a good sign for democracy either, I suppose.
Nope.
Hold on, pulling him up just to see what's the latest tweet here. 12 minutes ago, I will be speaking before a very important Pennsylvania State Senate hearing, which is in process now, talking about the massive voter fraud which took place in the 2020 election. And then below that, a blue exclamation point. This claim about election fraud is disputed.
That tweet is almost entirely wrong. It's not a hearing. It's a Republican meeting at a Wyndham Hotel in Philadelphia, where Rudy Giuliani just suggested that not only did Trump win the swing state of Pennsylvania, he also won Virginia, where Trump actually lost by 10 percentage points. So, you know, they have not dropped this. We've all sort of, you know, taken a deep breath as the votes have been certified in enough states to reach that 270 electoral vote, college vote. But it's still going on.
Heather, are you sure it's at the Wyndham Hotel and not at Wyndham Total Landscaping?
I will have to fact check that and get back.
A round of applause to Eric Zorn, ladies and gentlemen. That is the funniest thing of the week. Well, yeah, snap. Okay, well, we can leave Emily Murphy, whose 15 minutes of fame will probably lapse soon. But that was just, you know, she said we should have a constitutional amendment. Like, that's easy to do. But we should, and if we amend the Constitution, it won't just be for that. But she said that there's too much authority ceded to her office to sort of grant this transition. If it's that important, why is it up to some anonymous administrator? Well, to that, I say, if it is up to you, lady, then just do your damn job. There's no, you are not calling the election. She said, it's not my decision who's the president. Nobody said it was. Just give him $6 million. Somebody's got $6 million. Give him $6 million. And the the clearance they need as well. Anything else, Eric, that you want to just chime in on presidentially, what we've seen either about the transition or some of the things the president has been up to this week?
Well, I wrote a column today in praise of Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger. I borrowed some material from Lisa's old columns, actually, to write that. But it has to do with how Kinzinger, his district sort of rings Chicago, the exurbs of Chicago. It's a heavily red district. And he's been throwing shade at Trump for the past 5 years. He votes with Trump a lot. He's a conservative Republican. He's not anybody I would ever vote for, but he has been tweeting at Trump, telling him to drop his challenges and to basically accept what's going on. And he feels like he's kind of shown a voice of what I consider to be sort of mature grown-up Republicanism in this country. And I think, one of the things I wanted to say in that column was I do feel like at the end of the day, there are enough Republicans who love this country and love democracy that they're going to accept this election result. They're not going to overturn it in order to satisfy the needs of this extremely needy man who's now our president. And I know some days it seems just like chaos is just around the corner. But I do think, I know a lot of people who lean right, who are right. And I think that they're big boys and girls, and they understand how it's played. And they'll got to come back and get them next time. And Kinzinger seems to be a real voice of reason. I think Romney has been saying the right things. So you're seeing more Pat Toomey now that these Republicans are coming out and they're finally realizing that they shouldn't be afraid of Trump. One of the points that I made in this column was that Kinzinger's been bashing Trump for 5 years in heavily red district. He won re-election against a Democrat, and he outpolled Trump in just about every area of his district. I mean, so you don't have to be afraid of Donald Trump. You can be your own person. And so that would be my last thought on this.
I think, too, that he sort of, I'm trying to figure out whether his comment may be sort of serve as a bellwether, I guess. Forgive me if I have this wrong, Eric, but I did read your column, and I thought that he was also saying that, look, I've gone from sort of being, chastised and told that I'm with sort of I'm part of the sort of the deep state. And that that has sort of waned, and that people have come around to sort of saying, all right, you should have done more for him, or I see what you're saying. So I just wonder if that's what maybe that's some good news, in all of that. Maybe I'm reading into it too much, but I just sort of felt like, okay, if attitudes have changed toward him, he's not getting the grief he used to get. Maybe this may be what we see nationally.
Yeah, he said that the calls to his district office were very negative, especially at first when he was telling Trump to man up and take his defeat. But that those calls have waned, and I think you're right. I think that as the returns come in and as we go along, and they just don't present any evidence of significant voter fraud, so they can't make this. They can't make the argument. It's like and even if you could at this point, it would be so late and so disturbing to the country that it wouldn't be worth it. I mean, that's why Al Gore ended up dropping his challenge, which was he just thought it would rip the country apart.
Mm-hmm. Eric, did you in doing the legwork for that column or in its aftermath hear people talk about him as a potential gubernatorial candidate in Illinois?
But when I even asked him about it, and of course he gave the answer that he gave on TTW last night, which is like, well, I'm not thinking about it. I'm thinking for the political answer. I'm focused on the job I have to do. But he did say, he said, if the opportunity presents itself, that he would seriously consider it. So I think I can see him running for governor in 2022. I could see him challenging Tammy Duckworth, especially if Duckworth goes to the cabinet and there's another Democratic replacement in there, someone who doesn't have quite the same length of service. I think he would make a pretty good a pretty good statewide candidate. But because he's kind of an Illinois Republican in that he's not an extremist, and I could see him being a really plausible gubernatorial or senatorial candidate.
Speaking of the new cabinet, did you see the description of the new cabinet members, such as we know them so far, the nominees, as a casting call for the Avengers? They were all standing in a semicircle with similar suits and ties on, all looking very fit and thin and They looked like they were about ready to spring into action at any moment. They had the matching face masks on. It looked like some sort of team. And I don't want to read too much into it. We'll see how well these people manage our affairs. But I was just so happy to see people that weren't cuckoo bananas. There, I've used that phrase twice now. But who I just sort of had some confidence in, or at least thought were calm. It just didn't seem like a frickin' circus to me. And I was so happy to see that. Okay, that's my gut reaction to a photo op, but I felt good about it.
Well, I didn't know about Tony Blinken, the new Secretary of State designate's family history, that his stepfather was in a concentration camp during the Holocaust and that he was saved by American troops and that he was, you know, he, and then he immigrated and helped raise him. And like, you know, that was just an incredibly just emotional story that he told. And I think, you know, if it just, you know, how different a tone can you set? I mean, that just encapsulates it right there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, there was another headline this week. We had 30,000 on the Dow. The president and vice president came out to champion that in a very strange 60-second press conference. A hot mic caught one of the reporters going, well, that was crazy as shit.
Let's all take a moment and applaud George W. Bush, who, of course, at the inauguration in 2017 is supposed to have turned to Hillary Clinton and said, well, that was some weird shit. And like, you know, God, if he didn't just nail all of the 4 years right there.
Yeah. Well, if we're going to do hot mic trivia, then we have to include Joe Biden leading into Barack Obama when he was signing the Affordable Care Act, because that was a classic moment, too. But it is interesting because Donald Trump in one of the debates said, if Joe Biden gets elected, the market will crash. The market will crash. You can find that clip. Obviously, the market hasn't crashed. It's been going up because we've got more vaccines coming out and because it looks like we're going to have a peaceful, however fussy, transition to a new administration.
To a rather a moderate administration, too. I think that the market going up is a reflection of Wall Street's confidence in especially with the Janet Yellen appointment for Treasury or nomination, suggests a sort of stability and also the vaccines you mentioned. And the idea that then Trump came out and basically took credit for it, talked about, well, you know, this is the what X number of time we set a record in the Trump administration and then he walks off. It's all about him. It's all about his ego. It's all about he can't make it about the country. He can't make it about anybody but himself. And it's so infuriating to see. But I'm so thrilled. I'm thankful that we're going to see the end of him. And what is it? 56 days now. I should have a calendar up in my office.
But surprised yes. You don't. You were tweeting, Eric, about whether or not you wanted to see him sort of carried off in some sort of fit or, you know, peacefully transition.
Well, the Boston Globe did an editorial, which one of the lines was on the way. Well, Americans don't want to see the president dragged out of the Oval Office and frog marched, out. And I just said, wrong. I would love to see that. I would pay to see that. And apparently the Globe was inundated with responses just like that. And they had to write like a second piece saying, well, okay, maybe we're wrong about that. Maybe America does want.
What do you think it's going to be like? What will that day be like?
My prediction, I think he will leave before that day. I don't think he's going to give the media the pleasure of filming him. He's going to go golfing one day to Bedminster, and then he's going to hop a plane down to Mar-a-Lago, and he's just going to, and the White House, he'll be gone from the White House.
It's like LeBron James in the playoffs. He's just walking off the court like, so it's over. I don't need to be around the rest of this.
Yeah, I can't. He's not going to be at whatever swearing in ceremony there is. You remember the scene with Trump and the Obamas where they're standing there Obama gets on the helicopter and flies off. This is sort of the ritual now, right? Where the administrations overlap and the old president gets on the helicopter and flies out and the new one waves. We're not going to see that. Trump is going to just evanesce. That's my prediction.
How about you, Austin? Give me that. Give me the scene from somewhere in the transition.
I mean, if it's like anything we've seen before with Trump, it will be maximizing media exposure. So you do the craziest thing possible to control the narrative or get your voice into the narrative. So it will be probably something more bombastic than that, or something more ridiculous.
Austin, I was thinking that, like, he would hold a consecutive rally. At the same time, he would have a rally with his supporters at a gun shop in Pennsylvania or something, whatever, you know.
Yeah. At the other end of the mall.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess he'd have to apply for a permit. Maybe they would just show up, but that might be too close to the Biden joy, so he might not want to do that. But
But you could say, look, all these people are not here for the inauguration. They're here for me.
They're here for me. Biggest ever. Times two. 2.0.
Oh, there's not going to be a crowd. Biden is not going to have
I hope not.
Public. No. Well, no, of course he won't. It would be very off-brand for him to do that.
But I think people may show up. I mean, they may show up just to kind of see. I think, you know, that's my sense of it. People may show up anyway. He may not want that, but people may show up.
So, Lisa, how do you think Trump's going to go? Do you think?
I don't know. I don't have a sense of it, because on the one hand, he's somebody that hides out, right? Like all of these press releases I get, like no public events. Okay, I'm going to show up in the press room and talk about the Dow for 30 seconds or 60 seconds and not take questions. So there seems to be a level of almost embarrassment in some ways. And he's in his bunker. So he could do that. So he could even ask, like, I'd like to just sort of leave in the cover of night. Or it could be something bombastic. I honestly can't get out of my head. I had a very hilarious and gloomy coworker, newspaper coworker, at another newspaper, who used to say, all right, when they make the job cuts and they come for you, go limp. And so I cannot get that guy out of my mind and thinking, oh my God, what if the president went limp and just, I'm not, you're going to carry me out of here.
Like a bear attack or something. Yeah. Just play dead.
Heather, what's your prediction for the?
I expected him to travel to Mar-a-Lago for Thanksgiving and just stay there, not come back. And I suppose he could do that for Christmas as well and just not come back. That just seemed on brand to me, because he only operates in two ways, right? The biggest spectacle ever, and barring that, he just completely retreats. And you know, I sort of feel like if he was really interested in holding more rallies, that he would have done so already at this point, post-election. And, you know, I don't think it is straining objectivity to say he's not a good loser. So I don't, you know, he's not going to sit, you know, during Biden's inaugural address, you know.
Especially since he doesn't think he lost. Maybe the, you know, raison for not showing up would be because it wasn't fair. I didn't lose.
Yeah, it's hard to sort of understand sort of what's in his brain, and like whether he is sort of on some fundamental level understands he lost, or whether he's just completely living in denial. I don't know how to parse that. But I also know that he wouldn't want to be in a public situation where he is not the center of attention. And he would not be the center of attention.
Right. And I wonder how many people would show up for a rally right now, given the way the pandemic is raging through the population and there's family obligations people have. It's getting colder. There's no election coming up. I could imagine him having a rally that makes the Tulsa rally look like a success. You'd have a couple thousand people in a huge parking lot and it would just look pathetic. And that's one thing he really can't do if he wants to maintain his political future.
Funny, though, because he does like the brawl. You know, I was thinking about this, Lisa, when you were saying he's kind of in a bunker, but it's off brand for him, because he, I think, loves to argue with the media and assert his point. But he has been strangely absent, and except for his tweets. And now they seem to be shifting their energy to those other two conservative, or I don't even think it's fair to call them conservative networks, those sort of crazy networks, but he hasn't wanted to engage with the media at all, and that's kind of strange. Go ahead, Lisa, if you want to say
something. Oh, no, I was just sort of thinking about Heather's take on this, that that sort of makes me worry a little bit more, the thought that he wouldn't come back. Cause I sort of think anything that sort of would sort of kind of jog from what's supposed to happen, sort of the transition of power, everything we've read now, we've been reminded again, sort of why there is this sort of strict, you know, kind of transition of power, to have somebody there. And then they sort of hand the baton to each other for exactly the reason, Heather, you brought up about sort of 9/11 and how we're very vulnerable during these, yep, during these times. So that kind of makes me a little bit nervous. I know that may sound strange to his detractors who would like to see him go right now, but I do think anything like that could sort of, you know, make us vulnerable, to our enemies. So I'm kind of stuck on that now.
Absolutely. No, I mean, there's a reason that this is choreographed the way that it is. Yeah. And, you know, I have always watched inaugurations and sort of rolled my eyes at the cable news, you know, anchors being all like, and now we witness the, you know, peaceful transfer of power. Because, you know, on one hand, what else was supposed to happen, right? But I think that what we've learned, or at least what I've learned, is that it was always far more fragile than we were led to believe. Mm. And that sort of pomp and circumstance and ceremony papers over real cracks in sort of our checks and balances and systems. And I think that Trump not showing up, which would honestly be almost on brand at this point, because it would be the most shocking thing he could do. I think, you know, it's not the cause of the crack. It's just another sort of spotlight on those cracks that have always been there, but that we told ourselves weren't that big a deal. It was fine. Everything was going to work the way that it was supposed to. And of course, we've learned it works up until it doesn't work. And right, then it's too late.
And democracy cannot work without the peaceful transfer of power, where the winners take over and the losers go away quietly. If you don't have that, then that is the alternative that we have to just fighting it out on the streets for power, right? And if we don't have that, if we don't have it literally, and I think I would agree with Heather, symbolically, that's trouble.
Heather, I'm going to give you $10 if the next time you're on Chicago Tonight, you use your announcer voice that you just, your network announcer voice. Thank you.
Heather, this is Heather
Sharon. I'm worried Phil Ponce will think I'm making fun of him.
By the way, Dr. Allison Arwady said today that if a vaccine became available, she would be first in line to take it. Not all high-ranking doctors and medical directors and types like that are saying that, but she said she would. And I suppose you also heard she said she thinks that the first line of vaccines will be here mid-December. That'll go to medical workers, healthcare workers in hospitals, and then it'll trickle out to other healthcare people. And sometime in the summer, we'll get it. But as it should be. But I must say that was really encouraging news today, even as we're ready for, you know, a bad, long, hard winter here. I've moved my we're out of the woods date from July 18th to July 9th. July 9th at 11:28 in the morning now is the all clear for me. So I just wanted to share that with you. Are you guys as optimistic? Are you trending optimistic based on the vaccine news, et cetera, that we've been getting?
So the mayor this morning said, we can see the light at the end of the tunnel, but we are still in the tunnel. And I think that that is where we are right now. So, you know, there was no guarantee that the science behind the vaccines were going to work. And, you know, it's hard to overstate how encouraging the news that these vaccines are 90-95% effective are, because most vaccines, when they're first formulated, are somewhere north of 50% effective. So these vaccines are not only the fastest to be developed in basically human history, but they're the most effective to be developed in human history. So yeah, I think it's important to focus on that good news. However, getting the vaccine to everybody who should get the vaccine is going to just be a massive, massive undertaking. And I think that the delayed transition between the Trump administration and the Biden administration could, in the end, have slowed that process significantly. My 1 year anniversary at WTTW is mid-April, and I've sort of in the back of my head said, gosh, wouldn't it be great to actually go to work for the first time by then? But I think that that's probably a little optimistic at this point. And let's not forget, you know, tens of thousands of Americans will die between now and then, between now and mid-April. There is no way around that. And that is sobering. And
what the number could be a 9/11 a day.
Correct.
That's one way to
correct.
Yeah, I think I'm long-term optimistic about it. I did a piece the other day talking about how encouraging I found it that the Chicago Marathon had actually set a date and said, we're going to do this. It's October 10th of next year, so it's a ways off. But just the fact that that light is there at the end of the tunnel, and I believe in that. I think that we'll be fine by then. But getting the vaccine to journalists, you know, I mean, let's face it, around this virtual table here, none of us are exactly essential employees, maybe Heather, but the rest of us are not essential employees. And so we're going to be like toward the back of the line. So it may be late summer before we're vaccinated. But of course, by that time, maybe because of all the people who have been vaccinated, the pandemic will just not be as frightening and we'll feel much better about going out and partying and so on. It'll be very interesting to see how our society reshapes itself, whether all these months being working from home means that people are going to be working from home a lot more, whether office culture is going to come back, whether movie theaters are going to come back, whether we're going to feel the same about a lot of the things that we used to do.
Well, one of the bar owners that everybody seems to go to, he must be the only bar owner in town, and I won't name him because it irritates me, but he says that after the pandemic came the roaring 20s,
right?
He believes it will be something like that.
A lot of pent up demand for.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. Could be.
A lot of bootlegging.
Right. Isn't.
Well,
we've been making gin in my bathtub anyway since March, so.
I heard that about you.
Needs a homegrown martini. I'm your guy. Hopefully that doesn't then follow up with a crash, you know, in what it'd be 2030 or something like that, 2029. Let's talk a little bit. Speaking of, I don't know, are we speaking about the city now? Heather, can you catch us up on the mayor's budget?
Well, the city has a budget for 2021, although it was passed on just the narrowest possible margins of Chicago history. So it needed 26 votes to pass, and the property tax levy got 28 votes, and the budget itself got 29 votes, with one Alderman Stephanie Coleman, flipping between the two votes. And it's on one hand a victory for Mayor Lightfoot because, you know, this is the big test that every mayor faces every year. But I don't really think until we heard those votes come in that we expected it to be quite that close. And that close vote was only successful because she made several significant concessions and changes. There's now more money for violence prevention programs. There's a pilot to try to send non-law enforcement agents to help calls for help from those suffering mental health crises. And there are no layoffs. Originally, the mayor was going to lay off 350 city employees in March unless there's another federal relief package. And now that won't happen after a deal with the Chicago Federation of Labor. But what I wish more people had talked about, and which I did my best to write as much about as possible, is the fact that this budget relies on $1.7 billion in refinancing, as well as another $1.4 billion that the city plans to borrow to fund the first 2 years of a five-year capital plan. Now, that capital plan was sort of the last, you know, submission as well. So, you know, this budget is really balanced, you know, on taxpayers in the future. And I think that it sets up a lot of really hard decisions for Lightfoot in the coming years and not a whole lot of goodwill left for her on the city council.
That borrowing is really important. And I think to say that this is like a disappointing budget should be an understatement for every person who voted for Lori Lightfoot. Everything she talked about changing about business as usual in Chicago is sturdily intact in this budget. It is the same as a daily budget. It's the same as a ROM budget. And it's incredibly, incredibly disappointing. What makes it even more disappointing is the fact that when she presented it initially, it was seen as more of a wartime budget, which is what Chicago needs. There should be shared sacrifice. It shouldn't all be up to tax and fee hikes to close the budget. And instead of having shared sacrifice, the budget that was passed has this massive structural deficit that's papered over with accounting gimmicks and tax hikes on the poor and middle class. And meanwhile, special interests that always get a great deal in the budget, specifically government unions, had no sacrifice whatsoever. And that's really, really disappointing. We're going to see poor people pay more in gas taxes and different fees and different tickets, more in property taxes. Property taxes are going to automatically now increase every single year without a vote, taking political pressure off of that and making it just an automatic increase in taxes on people every single year. And the scoop and toss is just simply unacceptable. It's business as usual in Chicago. It's basically like, you know, I just got a $5,000 check I just found in the mail, so I'm going to get a mortgage on a house that cost me $5,000 a month for the next 30 years. That's what this is like. It's using one-time windfall for recurring revenue, which is what you're not supposed to do.
Heather,
hurts your kids and hurts your grandkids.
Heather, can you explain?
So it was a horrible budget.
Can you explain? She identified 300 job cuts that she was going to make. And then after she got some pushback from the alderman, and she said, okay, well, we'll use marijuana revenue and we won't let those people go. What kind of jobs were those? And are those arguably expendable positions?
So nobody knows, because what the budget team basically did was to sort of take those savings and pencil them in and sort of say, we're going to figure out how to save this much money with personnel reductions after the first of the year. So, you know, there were never specific, like, we're going to cut streets and sand by, you know, X number of positions, because I think the mayor rightly saw that if that was in the plan, it was going to be a way for people to say, you know, you can't do that, people won't get their garbage picked up, or you can't do that, people won't get their trees trimmed. So they sort of pushed that decision down the road and then ultimately said, you know what, we're just going to borrow $15 million to make up for the difference. And, you know, I feel like a little bit of a Cassandra sometimes, and I'm channeling my inner Austin Burke, but it's really hard to overstate how incredibly leveraged the city is. Like, the city has just so much debt and pays nearly $600 million a year just in debt service payments. That's interest and fees and that sort of thing. And I, you know, I'm sure each of us could come up with a way to spend $600 million in a more fun way than paying bank payments, right? So but that's the trade-off. And, you know, to some extent, Lori Lightfoot is dealing with problems that were left to her by Daley, who were left to her by Emanuel. But I don't think Austin's wrong when he suggests that this is a budget that could have been, you know, proposed by Daley or Emanuel, except for, you know, some minor tweaks at the edges with that violence prevention money and that and mental health service money and that sort of thing. But, you know, I think that it's going to be difficult for the aldermen who voted for the budget, who consider themselves progressives, to defend that vote. And I think it will be potentially a problem for Lightfoot if and when she runs for re-election in 2023, which I remind you is just around the corner.
Yeah. What sacrifices? Austin said there are no sacrifices in there. Would you agree with that? I mean, that she really, was she just not willing to be, you know, be brave and say, look, we have to make some painful cuts here? Is this
like one of these? There are no significant service cuts. Now, what they did was they reduced about 1,900 vacant positions. So those vacant positions won't be filled. And, you know, about 600 or so are in the police department. And that was enough to lose the vote of sort of pro-police aldermen like Alderman Napolitano from the Northwest side, and then Alderman Quinn from the Southwest side, and Alderman O'Shea from the far south side. But that was as far as she was willing to go. So, you know, the only sort of employee sort of sacrifice will be for people who earn more than $100,000 a year and who are not represented by a union. They will have to take 5 days of furloughs. But really, at that level, you're talking about department heads and the mayor and the deputy mayors. So, you know, that's not, you know, rank and file. But, you know, she only had two votes to spare. So, you know, it's not as if, you know, she had a lot of, you know, sort of leverage to say, no, we got to push these cuts through. You know, this was really by the skin of her teeth.
But go ahead, Lisa. Sorry.
I don't know. I do not want to see people lose their jobs. So I have no problem with figuring out another way to go. What are people going to do in this economy? You know, finding another job is not in tune. Maybe, I mean, Eric, I think you did too. I took 3 weeks of furlough. And perhaps that could have been negotiated with the unions and maybe go that way. But I'm not supportive. I don't support, you know, sort of like let's hack away and sort of cut these jobs. Let's lay off a bunch of people. No, I don't think that is sort of the ethical way to go. But I do not like that how that tax increase is set up, because that does, you're absolutely right, it gives everybody cover for 2023, and I think that is, I don't know, disingenuous. I just do it year to year, and yeah, it shouldn't be automatic.
And honestly, like, yeah, we should be immensely sympathetic toward anyone losing their job around the holiday, or anyone having to take furlough days, or anyone having to take a pay cut. But that's where the city's at right now, and you don't get to create a protected class of people who win every single time, and by protecting them every time, you're just making the eventual pain even worse. We're a city that's several notches below junk rating. We're on our way to Detroit financially. So until Lori Lightfoot came into office with a hole, but until you stop digging, the problem is only going to get worse. Mm-hmm. And what she again failed to do is address the elephant in the room, which is Chicagoans are overtaxed relative to the services that they get from their city. And that goes with whether you're rich, you're poor, you're middle class. And the only way to right-size those things is to talk about pensions, which are the elephant in the room. She says COLAs, the automatic compounding raises, are a problem in retirement. But she refuses to go up against government union special interests on any issue. And that hurts everybody in the city eventually, including people who work for the government.
Well, I mean, I think that's been the problem all along. It's not eventually. We're seeing that. We're seeing the fruits of that. That's been years of various mayors doing exactly that. So
what happened?
I guess who's tracking this, following it, and is sort of, I'm trying to look at both ends here, both sides here. I just feel like this budget, I mean, does everybody get branded off of this budget? I don't know, in this kind of year and in the kind of year we're going to have next year, it's a tough go. I don't want to see them borrowing that $600K of service debt. Makes me crazy. It goes to nothing. It does nothing for us, anybody.
Yeah. I mean, I think the problem is that this budget is going to be easy compared to next year's budget, because next year is the big, you know, pension ramp bill comes due. So, you know, I think that you could, there's no doubt there was no easy answer here, but in a world without COVID, this would have been the year for the city to say, look, we got to get our fiscal house in order. Yeah. It's like you've got a balloon payment coming due on your mortgage and you got to sell the car so that you know that you've got that cash to make that payment. And that just was not possible this year. You know, what also I think, you know, got lost in the coverage, and it certainly got lost in my coverage, is that, you know, the early days of the pandemic were marked by Mayor Lightfoot saying, Chicago's going to be fine. We're going to be fine. Yeah. We've got a really great economy. It's very stable. It's very diverse. We are not going to suffer. And, you know, all of us, you know, were guilty on some level of not thinking the pandemic was going to be as bad and as harrowing and as awful as it has been. But there's an argument to be made that had the city taken financial steps immediately in March, that this pain would have been less now, and the city would have been in a better position, closer to structural balance than it is now, going into what's going to be a very difficult year in 2022. And we haven't even really talked about sort of the whole political question of whether the city should continue to spend $1.7 billion a year to fund the police department, which is under federal court oversight and is, you know, struggling to reform itself, and, you know, in a sort of a Black Lives Matter, you know, world that we now live in, that was almost entirely not addressed. And, you know, was sort of, you know, I don't want to say papered over, but, you know, it wasn't sort of at the core of these budget decisions.
Okay, I'm no longer thankful. Talk me out of it.
I have the Paul Vallis tweet about all of this today. He said, passing budget that eliminates 614 police positions after failing to fill 1,000 CPD vacancies despite 700 murders that automatically raise property taxes every year, is reliant on $500 million borrowing and dependent on a massive federal bailout, is no cause for celebration. There's a Paul Vallis chiming in and echoing some of the things you guys have said. That's for sure.
See you in 2023, Paul Vallis. We know he's running again. He
Broom! I hope he has his broom ready to go.
Yes. He's criticized her at every turn, and we'll talk about his history at Chicago Public Schools another day.
Maybe Jim Oberweis will move into town and run for He has yet to lose the mayor's race.
So. He has not run for Chicago mayor. That's right.
Lisa had, I believe that was your story, Lisa, about how Lightfoot was celebrating the passage of her budget with like a steak and a cigar. Yeah, that maybe was the most infuriating story of the entire thing. This is a budget, again, that is raising taxes on poor people to pay for government workers that have gotten a sweet deal for many decades. And the fact that that's like the, we did it, guys, I got the votes on this pile of crap budget, status quo budget that's going to hurt the city long term, every resident in it, was so maddening. So thank you, Lisa.
Well, let me just say, I think I should have had a little more nuance. I got hit for that a little bit. And she did say that it was difficult. It required sacrifice from all around. And so I will do a give here. That probably should have been more nuanced. But she did say, you know, I'm glad this is done. And so, yeah.
Which is the problem with all this short term, like, oh, we found a bunch of money randomly here. We'll paper that over. And then next year, it's going to be the exact same fire drill. I think I've been talking with you guys on this show for a year. The last Chicago budget, we said the same thing. It's like, oh, phew, it's done. It's going to be a fire drill, a mess the next time, because the mayor is being cowardly and cruel.
Listen, everybody just needs to smoke a ton of weed, get those revenues going, all, and people will be even nice to each other.
One last thing, speaking of mayors, guys, have you been following the story about the mayor of Naperville who went down to Florida for his daughter's wedding, and then his niece, who is a bit of a BuzzFeed personality, has about 100,000 followers on one of the social media platforms. She said, okay, I have to say something. And at first she was a little vague about it. Then she outed the mayor, his wife, their kids and family for having gone to this unmasked wedding in Florida. The mayor afterwards said it was safe and he didn't appreciate the criticism and thought it was not valid. I wasn't at that wedding, so I don't know how safe it was. But I wonder what the sort of obligation is of a good citizen to warn everybody, because that's really the umbrella she's using for this criticism. She said, I have to tell people, I have to warn them about this. What's your reaction to that story generally?
That there's some family feud going on. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that was sort of the case, but I just feel like, John, that that there's some kind of feud going on. It is irresponsible. You know, I don't know what precautions he took, if there was sort of like, okay, I quarantined then after this or what.
Well, and it was at the same time that he was telling Napervillians to contemplate a mandatory mask rule. And he's in favor of that. So
that was why it blew up, right? I mean, the fact, like, number one takeaway was for me was, you don't snitch on family. That's the number one rule. And number two, you can't do the do as I say, not as I do stuff anymore. Yeah. We saw Gavin Newsom, same thing, like crowded restaurant, fancy restaurant, no mask on. Yeah. It matters a lot because it's about having skin in the game when you're making those huge decisions, which I like when, you know, Dr. Arwady says, I'm first in line for the vaccine. That's like, you have risk, you have skin in the game. And when officials who are making decisions about other people's lives are not obeying by those decisions, it's morally reprehensible.
Yeah, especially if you're in politics and you're making, ordering people around, telling them what to do like that, you can't go and violate those rules. It's not smart right now for anyone to be having a wedding. Testing, it's good. It's not foolproof. Quarantining when you get home, it's good. It's not foolproof. Nobody lives in an actual bubble. And testing does not guarantee that you're safe when you're interacting with people. And I think you just have to put these things off. We can see the end right now. And this is about when we're talking about Thanksgiving gatherings. And people are like, by God, I'm going to get together with all of my extended family. We're going to celebrate because this is America. If you want to have a Thanksgiving next year, then don't have one this year. That's kind of the point right now. And I think especially for politicians who are lecturing people about this, They really have to do what they say. They have to walk the talk, whatever the expression would be.
Just keep thinking about that wedding in Maine where, you know, it was 50 people and like some, you know, like, and it, you know, it turned into a super spreader that killed 7 people who didn't even go to the wedding. You know, they didn't make that decision. They just went about their lives and they were exposed to the virus by people who got the virus at that wedding. And then they died. And then all like 177 people got sick because of that wedding. Like, I've been married a long time. So like, you know, I only remember the highlights of my wedding, but to have it tainted like that, I can't even like imagine that, you know what I mean? And it just, you know, it just boggles my mind.
My son got married a few years ago and I do remember how important it feels. You get so caught up and this is what you're doing now. We're planning a wedding. We're getting married and the whole family and the resources. And it's just such a thing. And I can just imagine the Naperville mayor, Chirico, saying, you know, this is my one chance to have a wedding for my daughter. And by God, we can do it safely. And it's like, dude, in a few years, this is just going to be a photo book that you don't look at. It's so consuming, but it's in Austin. I don't know where you are on your plans on all of this. But
yeah, Austin, what are you going to do?
I'm getting enough feedback on wedding timing. I don't think I need any from the mincing rascals, but I really do appreciate it.
Let's make that the thrust of the rest of this podcast. Austin's
the time. It feels stupid to set a date for anything right now, right? Is kind of where we're at. So it's kind of like, okay, what would our wedding like be like in some future date where that could be possible? But in terms of like making calls to places, like it seems kind of futile right now.
Besides, guess what? If it's sort of like Thanksgiving, you have the perfect out. Now you don't have to spend $50,000 on a wedding, or now you don't have to sit with those people at Thanksgiving. The COVID happened, and so you're off the hook. Save your money. Don't sit next to Uncle Larry, who's the pain in the ass. You know, you've got the perfect out here.
I actually have an Uncle Larry. That's problematic how you said that.
Yeah. I don't know. That's not everybody's perspective. I was reading the a reporter by the name of Claire Bushey. She's a Chicago-based financial crime writer.
Yeah.
I read that
about sort of this deep loneliness that she'd already felt beforehand and now was sort of, you know, really sunk in it. And I think it really, and she quoted, she had a lot of great statistics in there about, okay, I may be, you know, living solo, but it's not just, you know, people living solo or, you know, not hitched or whatever. It's, you know, there's a percent of the population who's feeling the same loneliness and they've got a family. So, but it really got into the root of, you know, you have to understand like not everybody has married with kids and and that's their life. And not all of that is picture perfect anyway, but they long for that connection, even if Uncle Larry is a little nutty, but they long for that connection and that it's a very difficult time.
Yeah, that's well put. And I'm glad you mentioned that. And if you really do have an Uncle Larry, Austin, I'm just sick about this. I feel really bad about how we're...
It's all right. He'll be okay.
Larry, I think he'll understand, though.
He should. He's very understanding. He's got about 7 or 8 cats, big mustache, works on airplanes in Texas. He's almost like a kind of a cartoon.
Okay.
But
that's exactly okay. How an Uncle Larry should look.
Yeah. 100%.
100% on point.
Hey, come here, Austin. Let me talk to you. Let me tell you a little something about that podcast you guys do. We're out of time. Anybody want to chime in on anything else they're especially thankful for? Eric, you've been a little quiet over there. What would be the thing that you want to at least give thanks for publicly?
Well, I'm really thankful that we're not going to have listen to Donald Trump for 4 more years. I got to say that. I mean, aside from all the normal things, and I also got to say I'm quite thankful that we get together like this every week and talk about the news. This is really a nice highlight for me, and I hear from people who listen to us who enjoy it, and so those are two things aside from the usual
family, friends, health. Yes,
yeah, all that boring stuff. Yeah. No one else wants to say they agree, I noticed.
I was saying earlier, I was thankful for health and well-being of all, relative health and well-being of all my friends and family and you guys. But the documentary on Chicago, specifically around the 2019 mayoral race called City So Real, so people have time off over the holidays. It's awesome. It's 5 episodes. Truly a love letter and criticism of Chicago that shows it's all of its warts and all the beautiful things about it. Probably the best Chicago focused documentary I've seen, followed closely by his last documentary, Steve James' last documentary. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. It was really good. Yeah.
Heather in it. Is that right?
Heather makes appearances in it. All your favorite Chicago media personalities. You will. It's like a fun Where's Waldo.
any last ones from the ladies?
I was going to say that I was thinking this morning that I have been very thankful for a stable internet connection. It's been a little bit of an experience sort of figuring out how to be on TV regularly, plus to be on TV from home via, you know, the internet and all of that. And, you know, like I was saying before, like, you know, sort of all of these cracks in our democracy have been sort of exposed. It's like, you know, there's so much of the infrastructure of our lives that we depend on that we didn't think about, I think, nearly enough before this all happened. And that struck me this morning, and, you know, sort of how grateful I am for that to sort of be the biggest concern, you know, is the internet going to work today is, you know, pretty high class problem to have these days.
No, I get it. Lisa?
I am thankful for, I'm thankful that there's some kind of clearing that the end of the year might bring. And I'm also thankful for even some of the conflict that's happened, because I think it has made me smarter in terms of the political world. It's made me smarter. It's made me think about the other side at a time when that's not happening a lot. And I know that sounds weird, but I'm actually thankful for some of the conflict. That is the conflict that did not hurt people, that did not hurt lives, etc. But I'm also deeply thankful to my very patient husband, who has to listen to me on the phone talking to people who won't send me or respond to FOIAs, and does not judge me. and does not judge me for being a little bit hard charging. Is that the phrase?
It works.
And I am thankful to have these discussions with you about everything that's going on and to learn from you all.
Well, that's nicely put. And I'll echo a little bit of that. I want to just say I'm thankful for the people that listen to this podcast, share it with their friends, and give a good ratings. It remains the first or second most popular podcast on the WGN radio platform, and also the most listened to audio on the WGN radio platform. We get a little summary of what people listen to at our website, and we are usually half or more than half of the top 10 items. So I'll take that. And the other thing I'm thankful for is Queen's Gambit. I mentioned the Netflix show because now not only is it great viewing, but my son and I play chess every day or have an ongoing chess game.
That's
cool. He introduced us to chess and we aren't very good. And but it's every now and then like a pawn will take a queen and I'll go, oh, damn, I didn't see that. But we're having fun. It's a great connection for us. So.
I gotta say, I just started it last night. Watched the first episode. It's very gripping. So I'm looking.
I'm gonna tell you how it ends. It's I think 7 episodes.
Yeah, 7 episodes.
Yeah,
it's perfect size.
It could be longer, except then it might not be as good. Okay,
I certainly recommend it for women who enjoy watching stylishly dressed other women make boys and men cry vociferously. That is why I enjoyed the Queen's Gambit. Actually,
she doesn't start out as a fashionista, but oh, does she become one?
She gets there.
It's fun to look at too. That's for sure. And by the way, the last chess game that they play is an actual chess game that was famously played for some sort of championship. So I guess it's real in that regard. Okay, Eric, Lisa, Heather, Austin, nice to see you all, hear you all. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Elif Garris. Drop another pod on you next
week. I'm thankful for Elif.
Thank you, Elif.
Yes, thank you, Elif.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.